Hi, and welcome to the Inside Out Security Show. I'm your host, Cindy Ng, and I'm joined by security practitioners Mike, Killian, and Chris. Our 2018 Global Data Risk Report is out, and after thousands of risk assessments we've performed, we've looked at a random sample and found that 58% of organizations have more than 100,000 folders open to all employees. And there's more, but if people don't have time to read the findings, what's one thing people should know?
This is Chris. One of the other metrics that really stood out to me is that not as many, but you know, close by, 41% had at least 1,000 sensitive files open to every employee. Now, I think that's almost a bigger deal because non-sensitive content wide open to everyone, obviously not as big of a concern. If it's sensitive information, that's the stuff you really need to focus on and lock down. And as I've said before, it only takes one individual sensitive file leaked to cause reputational damage and kind of mess things up for a company to get their name in the news. So this is something that people should be aware of. If this is a random sampling and it's something that is indicative of how things are out there in the world at large, more companies need to be more careful with their data, for sure.
Hey, this is Mike. This is less about the actual data that's in the report and more the methodology. Because I think a lot of times people hear these reports and I guess they think they're biased, that they think that, oh, there's some way that they did this to make this seem worse than it is. And I worked on a lot of the data collection for this, and that is not the case. This is, if anything, I think is something that is incredibly real world, like how this data was collected and what came out of it. With a lot of these, I don't think they're rigorous in the scientific sense of, I feel pretty confident that if you ran these same sort of steps on your own network, you would find these same things. You would find these sensitive files open. You would find all this data open to everyone. There's a lot of people that kind of put their head in the sand about that instead of really thinking like, this is what it is, just plain and simple.
Hi, this is Killian. I actually just spent quite a lot of time reviewing some of that data for some other things I've been working on. But what I found most interesting about it was the fact that this seems to be pretty across the board. Again, it was a random sampling that we wrote the report off of. But I think, you know, we've seen it time and time again that organizations of all sizes and verticals and everything else struggle with similar fundamental challenges when it comes to data security. It's a sad state, but it's also hopeful in some ways that, you know, there's not one organization or another that's being singled out here. It's something that we're all struggling with together, and we're all looking for a solution together. And I think that's the big takeaway, at least, is that there's hope. When we find a solution or something that works for us, hopefully we can share it with others.
Thanks, guys. And for our regular listeners, if you enjoy your show, if you can rate and review our podcast on iTunes, we'll send you a deck of our InfoSec cards that's based on the Cards Against Humanity card game. To learn more, please visit Varonis.com/review. And the past few years, we've been releasing our global data risk report, which includes data from more than 50 countries and across 30 plus industries, including insurance, financial services, healthcare, retail, utilities, state and local and regional governments. How would you compare the data in our risk report to the user-generated data that everyone's really alarmed with about sharing our data to third-party vendors? Because everyone sort of expects that privacy is there, but depending on which network you watch or news organization you read, it's considered a data breach. But there is a real big difference between security and privacy. Data security, it focuses on the tools that deter hackers and cyber criminals from getting to your personal data, a company's intellectual property and trade secrets. Privacy is a right for an individual to be free from uninvited attention and scrutiny. These definitions are very clear, but our expectations aren't, and it's unfolding in a way that is very gray.
I'm just waiting for Killian to talk so I can disagree with him. I think the biggest thing is communications, which we're very focused on the technical things of encryption and are these things being done. To me, it's much more about the communications, and that's, I think, a level up from that. If you're getting like really clear consent for like what you're doing with the data and how it's being used, and there's mechanisms in place for people to, you know, find that out from you and different things. To me, that's the gold standard. Like, that's what we're moving towards. And that's what the GDPR, which we've talked a lot about, is really an embodiment of that, where a lot of what is in the GDPR is not technical. That they don't get down to like, oh, when you set up your web server, it needs to use these ciphers in this way. No, it has things in there that say like, oh, you need to describe this in a very plain, straightforward way that's not like overly jargony. You need to really get consent for this. You need to really, you know, find these things out. And it puts a lot of onus on doing that well, which I think is a positive change. Malfeasance and fraud, like everything. I just think that's, it just cuts to the root of the problem.
As kind of an extension of that, part of the problem is, again, we live in such a technical world. And when we look at some of the things that came out on all I'll reference Facebook, Cambridge Analytica. There was a lot of objection from the technical people that it wasn't a breach in the most technical term. But I don't think anybody's arguing that it's definitely a breach of confidence. So to the general public, it's a black box. They're entrusting their data and their information to third parties and expecting some level of privacy. And I think that goes right back to the heart of Mike's point, is that it needs to be clearly communicated what's going on with the data, who it's being trusted to, who it's being shared with outside of the first party that it's being sent to, and how are they making use of that. That's the thing that I don't think we really ever got a good handle on. So while something like that would not be technically a breach in terms of, we were talking about this before the show, but a crafty cyber attacker in an old warehouse wearing a hoodie getting into the system and doing something malicious, it was definitely a breach of confidence because the users using the platform didn't realize that their data could be scraped by a third party through completely legitimate APIs and things like that. So, you know, it's a gray area, but users do need to be informed so they can make that type of informed consent.
Yeah, I'll jump in here. It almost sounds like we're talking about the consent of the user who provides the data versus the consent of the third party. You know, people give their information to Facebook willingly, with the, as Killian said, with the expectation that Facebook will treat that with the respect it deserves and keep it from abuse. A breach sounds like it's the opposite of that, where the third party does not give consent to others to take that information. Whereas in the case of, say, Cambridge Analytica, the methodologies they used were legitimate, quote unquote, within the framework that Facebook operates. Would you agree with that? It's sort of like a whose consent is being given and what the expectations are that kind of defines which is which.
See, I would actually push back on that because, again, this goes to, I've been spending a lot of time in the GDPR, so I apologize for bringing it up again. But within that, it's not just the data, it's what it's used for. As a person, you need to consent for both. If you're consenting to authenticate with an app via your Facebook login for the purposes of, you know, sharing your email or getting your photos to be used for something that it's going to apply some goofy filter to them, that's one aspect of that consent. But then if it goes beyond that to a different use, it needs to be consented to. That if that is then used for retargeting ads around the internet, that's a different use. You didn't consent to that. That is then not a data breach, but I think Killian said it right. It's a breach of trust. It's a breach of using that data in the appropriate way. And I think when Cambridge Analytica was doing a lot of this, how we thought about that data, that second piece of how the data was used never came into it. And back at that time, I was actually writing Facebook apps. I wrote an app, a company that was doing like kind of like sports betting stuff and things and tied into Facebook so you could bet your friends and do all this stuff. And I feel I have a good grasp of this, and I think this was an overreach on Cambridge Analytica's part. Even the terms of service, I think, were violated. That I don't think it's fair to say that this is just how Facebook apps work, because there's a lot of restrictions in there about the kind of data you're allowed to keep with all of these services, with Facebook, LinkedIn, that it's not okay as a developer to sign up, use the API, copy down all the data, keep it yourself, and then do all this stuff on it, that as a means of interaction, it needs to be that you're calling this data live, that you're not storing it yourself, that there's limits on it. And those limits were clearly violated in this case.
Do you think that in this case, a policy control saying, hey, you really shouldn't do that, was sufficient protection on the data because it was all open? Even though they violated the terms of service, they were still using the API to get the data just like anybody else. So should there have been additional controls to prevent that, rate limited or something else?
At a technical level, it's really difficult. That if you're running an API and someone makes a request from you, I mean, this is just like a web page, that it's very hard to tell if you're the person running the web server, whether the client that just pulled down the web page is a bash script that I'm running on my Mac, whether it's Firefox, whether it's Chrome, all that can be easily faked, all of that can be run through, you know, all sorts of automated means of working. And it's very difficult. One of the things that Facebook did as part of all of this was they turned off their developer access, that they stopped approving new apps to just access all the data because I think it was given away too freely, and that there's a real shift in how we're thinking about this data. And to bring this back to the GDPR, like I've been explaining the GDPR to people as, oh, you know how you consider keeping credit card numbers as like, whoa, this is dangerous, toxic data, that if you keep credit card numbers in your system and you're directly using them, that it's a problem, that you have to suddenly, you know, adhere to all these standards. You are worried and scared about this data leaking out. You're encrypting it. You have all these controls and worry about it. And the GDPR is trying to move things forward to where companies and organizations think about user data, names and passwords and identifying things in the same way, that you think of it in the same dangerous sort of way you think about credit card data. And Facebook was handling credit card information instead of handling user data, this would be a whole different conversation. And they wouldn't just be handing out API keys to whoever signed up with their Gmail address, which is what they were doing.
I just read that Facebook wanted to enter healthcare and to extend their platform into that space, and it's been postponed. So I thought that was interesting. You're always protecting and defending developers by saying, what's the harm? And
yes, I have my t-shirt I'm wearing now. It says, what's the harm? Yeah.
And now, do you feel differently?
Somewhat. I mean,
because of,
I think it is very good to quantify these issues and to quantify the types of behavior and to separate them out and to consider them in different ways and to really get down to, like, because I don't think scaremongering is good, and I don't think just talking in hypotheticals is good either. I just want to deal with facts. I want to deal with a fact-based reality, and I want to deal with actual issues and grapple with those. And there is an element in there of trying to think ahead. A real thing is people share credentials across systems. And so that if your email address and a password is lost from one system, it's very likely to mess with another system and grant a whole bunch of access that wouldn't be available otherwise. So there's real harm there. I think there is less harm in certain areas.
Taking that stand a little bit further, how would you look to address the API issue, because it's completely open? Or what type of burden would it put on to developers if they had to do kind of a feature by feature justification? So like on Android, when you accept installing an app, you have to, it gives you a list of the different things it'll access, the address book, the camera, whatever it happens to be. Would it be sufficient for security and not a hindrance to development, in your opinion, to implement something like that? So you have to justify what data you're accessing and maybe tier it when calling an API, or would that be impractical?
I think that's great. And I think, like, in the course of, let's call them like OAuth authentication schemes, like, because that's most of what this is, where I write an app that lets you, you know, put kitten faces on all your pictures. I let you authenticate to it. That's via Facebook or Gmail or Twitter. That's OAuth, that general specification. And in there, there's typically scopes. And the scopes are the individual permissions, as you're describing. And since the concept of OAuth came out in scopes, we've seen a real shift where initially people slammed in every single scope they could get just in case. You know, that was very typical. And then gradually we've seen better and better user experience where then it listed out scopes. And so if you're asking for a lot, you knew people would probably bail out from using your app. So you scaled those back. And now with things like Android and other systems, on a case-by-case basis, you can decline that. So you can say, like, all right, I'm installing this, you know, calculator app on my Android. Maybe it shouldn't have photo access. Maybe it shouldn't have, you know, access to the camera. And you can selectively remove those as you're installing it. Something else that's just come out is now in our world, in the world of enterprise software network stuff, we talk a lot about like stale accounts. Like if you have a bunch of stale but enabled accounts in your Active Directory, that's bad. Like that's not good. I think the same thing is happening now with OAuth and apps, where if you have not used an application for 30 days, it automatically like locks out the app access from that. Because something that happens a lot is there'll be some popular app that does something dumb. Like, you know, it takes your picture and puts cat faces on it. And then, but it had a lot of installs, and then it gets bought by someone who wants to do something malicious with it. Suddenly they have access to a million different Android phones that they can, you know, update with a bad install of something. And so those are very practical things. And I think those are ways that the platforms can support both the developers, good developers, and protect their users.
We've been talking about security and privacy expectations, and Bill Gates' former cybersecurity advisor, he was even recruited by the CIA in the 80s. He dished out some advice, and I wanted to see sort of rapid fire responses. Do you guys believe in mobile payments? He said that if he was walking through a store and he was evil, he'd be able to connect to the store's wireless and the point of sales would be locked down, but Apple Pay would not.
That one, at least for me, I'm not overly concerned about, if only because I've had my physical credit card stolen so many times and had the number stolen so many times that it can't be really any worse than the protection that we have or trusting some random guy to take it in the back and swipe your credit card for a payment. So for me, I am fairly comfortable with that one.
We should just take Bill Gates' advice and all of us should just hire a personal cybersecurity advisor to help them navigate all these issues. That's my plan. If you have a resume, just write a really nice review of the podcast and then I'll contact you.
Yeah, I read one piece about this saying he recommended people have two computers, and he addresses the fact that, you know, I can't afford them. Like, yeah, a lot of people actually can't afford to have two computers, and it's kind of a strange tactic. I guess if you can afford it, fine, but I don't know. There's definitely other things you can do besides that.
He suggested that one computer have all your personal data and banking information, and the other one is for web surfing and email. Chris, what's another option?
Honestly, I do a lot more banking on my phone as opposed to on my laptop these days. So I do have a separate device that does that, but it's
antiquated.
Maybe.
I liked that suggestion. Actually, something that's I done for a while, but I never realized I was doing it until I read it in the article. I have, you know, a tablet that I'll use just for internet browsing and things like that, and it's not connected to anything else. You know, it's kind of a throwaway. And actually, I read an article, and I should have shared it with Cindy, but I forgot, about how cybersecurity experts are now really loving Chromebooks for that exact reason, to take to conferences and things. They've had a lot of security built into them from the beginning. They're relatively inexpensive. So this has become a really popular tool, at especially when going to, you know, untrusted environments or the security trade shows.
Yeah, I take this advice too. I use Killian's tablet for everything, for all my surfing. It works great. It's very inexpensive because he doesn't know I'm doing it.
Because I accepted all the default permissions on that app.
Yeah, it's great. You just see the pictures I'm getting off this thing. It's amazing.
He has 6 different credit cards. Is that excessive or not?
See, I think this advice should just go further and you use one computer per website you visit to keep everything separate, everything nice and clean.
I think maybe 6 credit cards is a little bit excessive, but that's not a terrible idea in terms of separating kind of your tiered payments, depending on what you're doing. You know, that's not necessarily bad advice. I mean, heck, even going back to the device thing, I have a personal device and a work device, mobile phones. I carry 2 phones because I don't want to commingle that data. Again, that's just, I've done that for many years as well.
I would say there are services now that are starting to where it just generates one-off credit card numbers for you that you can use in different services and things.
Some banks offer that too as a service. I think Bank of America does, and there's a couple others, but I'm not positive on that. So it is becoming more common as well. And actually, I think same with Android Pay. I think they actually generate a separate, like, Android Pay credit card number that's linked to your main number as well.
One point that I did like in here was the idea of knowing the difference between debit and credit and the repercussions if one of those is compromised. I don't necessarily leave my debit card at home, but I do use only credit when I shop online. I will not ever put in my debit card information on any website, just because that way, if the credit card is compromised, then that is something that the company is liable for as opposed to you being liable for it. So I think that makes sense. I do like to carry cash on me, though, so I do need to have my card on me at some time when I get the cash. But for the most part, I don't pay for things with debit. I use it strictly as an ATM card, and then I use the credit card strictly for payments to avoid using the debit card for anything. Do you guys do something similar or no?
No, but I feel like I should now. You're shaming me into better security practices, Chris. Good work.
That's a great suggestion. I can't even tell you the last time I've had my debit card out. I think it's actually in a safe deposit box in my bank, but I try not to carry cash either. So,
Killian, it's tucked between the tablet and the case. I was going to say it's tucked between the tablet and the case. I use it as well with the tablet.
Oh, good. Want me just to send a picture of it and make it a little bit easier?
Yeah, make sure you send the back so I get the 3-number like CVV code as well, please.
Yeah, that's always a tough one. again, it's a rare occasion where I run into one. Typically, I'll see it in like restaurants occasionally.
I just paid with Bitcoin.
That's it.
It's the new cash. It's great.
I think the only reason I end up ever having cash on me, truthfully, is because like I've gone out somewhere with multiple people and I'll pay with my credit card and they'll give me a couple bucks for it. So I'll just scroll that in my wallet. So it doesn't come up all that often, but that's not something to rely upon. But on the rare occasion that I need cash.
Killian secretly getting podcast money and not telling us.
Gotta get them royalty checks.
From big podcasts.
So we've been talking about our rights as users, and I came across an article about the rights of dead people, and there is something interesting that a lawyer said, that once you share information with someone, you lose control over how that information is protected and used, and you can't assert your privacy rights. Your friend's phone is searched, and the police sees the messages that you sent to your friend, and the same thing goes for sharing information with the deceased. After you release the information to the deceased, you have lost control of your privacy. So even though methods of unlocking your phone with the dead person's body part might be unethical, it's entirely legal.
Dead men tell no tales, but their cell phone's a different story, I guess.
I was just going to say, I think this is pretty spooky. The idea that, I guess the idea is to take, if somebody is involved in some sort of criminal investigation, you know, they're either a target or they were a victim or something like that. The idea is that legally you are allowed as law enforcement to use their fingers to unlock their phone. That freaks me out a little bit. They can't exactly give consent for that. I see why it'd be useful in certain situations.
All I know is if I'm ever the victim of a mob hit, I want it right in the face so Face ID doesn't work properly.
So a couple of things with that, Chris. I'm not entirely shocked. The first thing, you know, kind of right off the bat is as soon as that's, you know, the data's out of your hands, it's out of your hands. And if you send something to somebody, it is what it is. You have to assume that it's going to get out there. So, you know, that's maybe the lessons. We have to jealously guard our personal information. You never know what the other person could do with it. And specifically about the using a deceased person's fingerprints or Face ID to unlock the device, I'm not shocked. That doesn't surprise me whatsoever. You know, you're not, this isn't like a Weekend at Bernie's situation here where you're going to drag the guy into the courtroom and have the judge ask him if he consents to a search. Like, he's no longer with us, so.
Sort of reminds me of that movie with Denzel Washington and some bank, and some guy betrayed his friends, and then he started a bank, and then he had secrets about how he protected the Nazis or something.
Yeah, this is the Spike Lee directed Inside Man with Clive Owen.
Oh, yeah. I think he would care if he was dead and they'd be able to find his secrets.
Could we somehow come up with a sequel to this movie where we bring a digital Russell Crowe back, like a Virtuosity 2/Inside Man crossover movie where Denzel has to fight a virtual Clive Owen, team up
Outside with Man 2.
Virtuosity is a movie that nobody remembers, so you're welcome, guys.
I remember it.
Do we have a tool of the week?
Yes. And so for a quick callback, say you were in possession of Chris's phone and you wanted to snoop on the traffic between his bank account and between his banking app on the phone and his actual bank's web service, you would need a utility to do that. And typically, this is a big hassle. If you're like me, this is a big hassle snooping on Chris's phone. And so up to now, you've always had to do this complicated setup of like proxying the traffic through a computer to spy on it, and it's a pain. So there is a new tool called Charles. This is Charles Proxy. Now, Charles Proxy has been around for a long time, and it's awesome. This is a tool I bought years ago and used for all sorts of stuff, for development and debugging things. And so now there is an iOS version of this so that you can do SSL proxying, capture HTTP and HTTPS traffic, all from within the phone itself, which makes it much, much easier to do. So Charles for iOS, it is not an open source application. It is something you have to buy. Let me see how much it is. It's whatever it is, it's worth it. It's $50 for a license, and entirely just go buy it. It's so, so wonderful and helpful. So,
hey, Mike, you had a cybersecurity story with the Girl Scouts.
My daughter, Sinclair, is 7 years old and she's a brownie. They earn all sorts of badges and it's awesome. Huge fan of the Girl Scouts. They have a cybersecurity badge. It is a little dated and none of the other parents know that I work for Varonis or know anything about this. So they had the person they thought was really great, who was another dad, who's a nice guy, but had no idea what he was talking about, give like a lecture on what you should do. And it was interesting to me as someone who, I'm not going to say I'm great at this, but I feel like I at least know what I'm good and bad at with it comes to cybersecurity. And this guy was so bad. His recommendations were like, what you need to do is like every week you want to change your IP address so they can't track you. And you want to clear the cache on your browser so that no one knows who you are. And both in terms of like the information he was conveying to the kids, as well as it actually being of any practical use, was so bad on so many levels. I kind of took it as a lesson that we people who are professionals in this need to do a better job of education and volunteering and helping out other people. So a lot of work to be done.
Did you volunteer to help him?
I didn't want to call him out. So no, not at that time. But I talked to the troop leader about maybe doing something else at a different time. 100% support your local Girl Scouts. It's a cool organization.
Killian, you look like you're going to say something.
I was just going to say that clearly that information was wrong, and Mike is wrong too. You should change your IP address every 3 days. I mean, this is common sense, people.
Yes, as often as you change your underwear, you should change your IP address is what you're saying, Killian.
Well, more often than that. We're talking about important things here.
Oh, God. Disgusting. Thanks to Mike Buckby, Chris Kaiser, Killian Engler, and all our listeners for joining us today. Also, let us know what you think about our podcast by going to iTunes to rate and review us. Thanks, and we'll meet up again soon. Bye.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Cindy. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Support for the Inside Out Security Show and the following message come from Varonis. A Varonis data risk assessment doesn't take long. A 90-minute software install lets you map access to your directory services, classify files to discover what's sensitive, and start monitoring and analyzing user behavior. If you want to turn on the lights, Varonis can help. Visit info.varonis.com/podcast and get a free data risk assessment.